This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, Managing Editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us. We're ready to discuss the important events of this past week with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me on the show.
It's good to have you. Relations between America and Europe took another hit this week with a couple of economic moves by European leaders that give us a glimpse at the direction the world is taking. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Guys, we got some news from Europe that I think is a great example of some news stories that could be rather boring, but become really exciting when you adopt, you know, the Trumpet lens of looking at world events. Mm. So on Monday, European leaders met with China, and they had a discussion, a meeting that they've been having, I think, about every year with the Chinese on trade and economics. And for the first time, they were able to agree on a conclusion. Before, they've not been able to do that. The European Council President Donald Tusk said, "We are all aware of the fact that the architecture of the world is changing before our eyes." And they talked about wanting to build a new trade architecture. So that was Monday. Then the next day, the EU signed a deal to create the world's largest economic area. It would cover one third of the global economy. The EU calls it the largest ever free trade deal, or the largest ever trade deal. It covers 600 million people. It's between Europe and Japan, or at least the largest bilateral trade deal ever. So Monday, Tuesday, you had that. And then Wednesday, they decided they were going to sock it to the United States. Another record, this time a record fine on Google. So Google gives away its Android operating system. This has led to much more competition within smartphones. It's led to smartphones being dramatically cheaper. And according to the EU, this is bad for consumers. Now, it's not because they're worried about people spending too much time on smartphones or any of the social implications of having screens everywhere. They're arguing that it's anti-competitive because, you know, when Google give out this free software, they impose some install the Google Play Store. You also have to install a Google search app and some of these other things that people would probably want on their phone anyway, because have you tried using Bing? You don't try using it again. So at least that's my experience with it. When you look at this and what they've done to Google there with their record $5 billion fine, you look at that in context of everything else the European Union does. And the general rule is, if you're a Russian company like Gazprom with murky links to the Russian government and a history of blackmailing countries into submission to Russia, Europe will bend the rules to make sure there are no fines, to make sure you're allowed to do whatever you want. When Gazprom is very clearly violating those rules, they'll find a way to let Gazprom go through. When it comes to U.S. tech firms, it's the other way.
Yeah.
What they will find whatever way they can to hit you with fines. And the EU's antitrust division is, you know, basically this out of control structure in the EU. They can send in SWAT teams on dawn raids. They don't need a search warrant to do that. It can impose massive fines, but there's no kind of due process of that you would get in a criminal court against that. It's way more heavy-handed and less free of restraint than the U.S. Justice Department. And so they use that repeatedly to attack U.S. firms. But you look at what you had on those 3 days. You had Europe drawing close to China, Europe drawing close, creating this massive new trade area with Japan, and then the next day attacking the United States. And those 3 days are just a microcosm of exactly what we've been saying would happen with Europe economically.
Well, let's just start for a moment with those first two items. When you see the relations with China that you're describing, and then definitely this free trade agreement that it's made with Japan, you really have to think about that that prophecy that we've been talking about for years that Gerald Fleury brought up some years ago about a mart of nations.
Yes, it just leaps off the pages of Bible prophecy. So Isaiah chapter 23 has this prophecy about a mart of nations, and that chapter it talks about ships, it talks about oceanic travel. You know, it's talking about a trade agreement, and it singles out a number of nations in particular. It talks very much about Tyre, which that's a term the Bible uses to refer to this economic power that's building in Europe now, just as Tyre was anciently the big economic power of the region. And then it talks about Kittim, which is a biblical term for, and an ancient term for, China. And it talks about Tarshish, which is a biblical term for Japan. We talk about all of this in our free booklet, Isaiah's End Time Vision, and give more details on those identities. And you see exactly the nations highlighted, talked about specifically in this chapter that, like you said, we've been talking about now for years. You see them coming together in this trade deal. You know, you see this record-breaking, largest ever bilateral trade deal, largest ever economic area with these exact countries.
Mm-hmm.
And when Mr. Fleury's talked about that, he's also brought in these other prophecies found in places like Ezekiel 4 and 5, found in places like Deuteronomy 28, that talk about the United States and Britain being besieged,
mm-hmm.
about these powers ganging up on Britain and America economically, cutting them off from world trade. And then, you know, what else do you see from this week? Well, you see Europe finding a way to attack America economically.
Yeah.
It's still small compared to, say, a full-scale siege that the Bible talks about. But you see that, you know, they're moving closer to economically to Asia. And when they have an opportunity to hit the United States, well, they take that.
Yeah. Well, we talked about it, I believe it was last week, where it was the tensions that have arisen between Europeans and America over trade, and they're slapping sanctions on each other or putting certain tariffs on certain products. And Europe is essentially using this as an opportunity to turn more directly to strengthening its economic ties with Asia. And it really is, these economic ties developing between Europe and Asia really are deliberately aimed at undermining American economic dominance.
Yes, and Europe goes really hard at trying to be the ones that write the rules for world trade. I mean, just to pick a kind of petty but accessible example. So, you know, if you don't see much feta cheese on the shelves of UK shops anymore. You see a lot of, quote, feta-style cheese or Greek-style cheese. And that's because the EU has lots of strict rules about, you know, only cheese from this particular part of Greece is allowed to be called feta cheese, or only cheese or any wine from the Champagne region of France is allowed to be called champagne. If it's the same product but from somewhere else, you can't call it that. And so you're seeing Canada signing up to those rules. You're seeing Japan, at least in earlier versions, I haven't seen the full version of this trade deal, but earlier versions, they signed up for that. And so you're getting now this like we said, covering a third of the world that is coming to these rules. Those rules are going to start to go global now,
mm-hmm.
because everybody's signing up to them. Now, that's, like I said, that's kind of a petty example, but as they become the rule setters, well, they're going to be setting just a whole host of different standards now. And, you know, more and more, I think even companies, if they trade a lot with other countries, they'll start complying with that in the United States as well. So they're becoming the leaders and the standard setters for the world. So if you'd like to know more about these prophecies, about what's going on here, like we said, we've got the Isaiah's End Time Vision booklet that goes into this in a lot of depth in exactly what the Bible says. We've also got an article by Mr. Brad McDonald from last year called Trade Wars Have Begun, and that, you know, that applies it very directly to world news. It takes you through those prophecies and shows you how so much has happened in fulfillment of those prophecies already. So we can put a link to that article in the show notes. That's Trade Wars Have Begun.
All right. Well, thanks very much for that, Richard. We are talking about China, and the question that we want to ask now is China about to conquer Taiwan? The Trumpet has watched this story for decades, and some activity this week suggests it's getting closer to actually happening. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
On Wednesday, China's People's Liberation Army started a six-day drill. And this took place in a part of the East China Sea that's very close to Taiwan. So these are live fire drills. They simulate real combat. And the objective of these is to basically send a warning to what China calls Taiwanese separatists. In reality, though, these, you know, they could be called Taiwanese pro-independence individuals. Their goal is for Taiwan to be sovereign, just an independent democratic country free to take whatever path that its people choose. But the Chinese Communist Party sees Taiwan differently. They see them basically as a rebel province, and the Chinese are determined to bring Taiwan officially under Beijing's control. So these drills are essentially just a scare tactic, with China trying to show Taiwan that they have the military muscle to subdue Taiwan.
Just to make sure that I understand, it was the Chinese government didn't come out and say, we're trying to send a message. This was analysts who were looking at this and saying, clearly this is what China is trying to do.
That's right, yes. I don't think there's been an official statement that that would say that quite so boldly. But for most any China watchers, it's pretty clear because of the location of these, and also because this isn't the only instance of drills and military, you know, muscles being flexed right in the periphery of Taiwan. Back in January, China sailed its aircraft carrier, actually the whole fleet that goes along with the carrier, through the Taiwan Strait. And then just in March, China held another large-scale military exercise very nearby. So the proximity of these and the timing of these, it's beyond coincidence. But yes, I don't know if the government has yet, you know, boldly proclaimed what it's doing there.
Well, maybe you can just give us a little bit of background on why this is such a prickly issue and why China is trying to send this message.
Sure, yes. Well, back in the you know, the early 20th century, there was a civil war raging for quite a long time between the Kuomintang party there in China and the Communist Party. And so shortly after World War II, the communists won, and they essentially drove the Kuomintang. They fled the mainland, and they went to the island that we now know as Taiwan. So China, ever since then, has really just viewed the Taiwanese as breakaway, you know, just kind of a breakaway state, that it's one of their core objectives to subdue them and bring them officially back under control of China once again. But of course, the Taiwanese, they think that they're a free country. So that's really at the heart of what's happening here.
And why is it that this would be is becoming more of a pressing concern for China right now?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One of them is just that, you know, we've spoken on the show before about how Xi Jinping is basically leader for life of China at this point. So he's able to rule for as long as he wants to, or until he dies, perhaps. But he is in a position unlike his predecessors. His predecessors could say, yes, reclaiming Taiwan is a core objective, and we do have to do that, but they could always kind of kick it, you know, talk strong, but kick the can down the road and say future leaders can actually make that happen. With him, though, he is the future of China. So he's sort of in a position where he may feel forced or compelled to personally take action in a way that his predecessors wouldn't have felt. And then there's also just the role of the U.S. decline. You know, ever since 1950, the Taiwanese have lived in fear of invasion of China. But the one thing that's prevented that has been the United States. America has given them political support, a lot of military equipment, and most importantly, security assurances. They've said, if you're invaded, we've got your back. But now the U.S. is showing itself to be war-weary. You know, we're tired of being the global policeman. President Trump wants to make America great again, and in some ways that means not policing the rest of the world. And of course, President Obama had a similar objective for different reasons, but the U.S. power has been globally just in retreat for quite a while now. So because of that, China sees that those security assurances that have prevented them from invading Taiwan are now very thin, and it may be the time to push harder.
So looking at this prophetically, what is it that makes this of such interest to us? Why have we been talking about this at the Trumpet for some time?
Well, back in 1998, President Bill Clinton came out, and he essentially made statements that equated to opposing Taiwanese independence. And that was a real turning point for U.S. foreign policy. It left Taiwan very confused. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury at that time said that Clinton's statement meant that it was really only a matter of time until Taiwan would come back under China's rule. He wrote an article in our August 1998 Trumpet called Taiwan Betrayal. I'll just read a really short quote from that. It says, "The Taiwanese leaders pressured the president and America to speak out against our freedom-loving friends in Taiwan. America has showcased its broken will to the world. How could anyone fail to see that Taiwan is destined to become a part of mainland China? And it's going to happen for one reason, because of a pitifully weak-willed America." So, you know, if you look at how America's security assurances are so much in doubt today, and just at how China is growing so powerful and aggressive, it's easy to see how Mr. Fleury's forecast there could very quickly come to pass. And that would be perfectly in line with what Richard was mentioning about Isaiah 23, about China becoming powerful and coming to be one of the main powers that dominates global trade at the expense of America. You know, if Taiwan is added to China's muscle, that would really represent a major stride toward just advancing Chinese power and strength, and a major diminishment in American power in the Pacific, especially there. So I think if you read Isaiah's End Time Vision by Mr. Gerald Fleury and read the statements in there about China and how they'll ally with Europe and all that, when you consider Taiwan as part of that equation, it just makes it seem all the more pressing.
Yeah. Well, we'll put a link to that article from Gerald Fleury, Taiwan Betrayal. That's the one back from 1998,
right,
that he wrote. And we also have an article about these exercises. China pushes at Taiwan with large-scale military exercises. There's even a map there you can see of exactly where the drills are taking place and how close they are to Taiwan. It's helpful to get that picture of what's going on there. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. Over to the Middle East now. Some bold remarks from Israel's defense secretary today. He says Israel is being forced into a war. For this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, it has been really heating up on the southern border of Israel with Gaza for the past week. The first indication we had of that this week was Channel 10 talking about how the military earlier this week had been told to prepare by the political class or by the political echelon to prepare for a large-scale war in Gaza. And there was the 162nd Armored Division that had a training exercise this week to take back even Gaza City. And so this is like a full training for an incursion into Gaza in order to stop both the rocket fire and these flying devices that explode and cause these massive fires all over Israel, all over the south of Israel, where we've talked about this and written about this in the Trumpet. And they've basically given, the Israelis have basically given the Hamas until today, until Friday, to stop sending these bombs over, stop firing the rockets, or you are pressing us into a corner and we are going to act decisively, to the point where Avigdor Lieberman, the defense minister, did say that this is going to be a large-scale war, outstripping even 2014 Operation Protective Edge. This would be worse than that. That was where a couple thousand Hamas and Palestinian members killed and 60-some soldiers for Israel were killed. And so this is really serious. These balloons have been coming over into Israel for a while. But Israel is getting to the point where it feels like it's had enough.
So can you put this in context for us, Brent? We've talked in recent weeks about just how much Iran's pressure on Israel is increasing. And we've also talked about how Iran and Hamas seem to have had something of a reconciliation, and that Iran's policy seems to be a bit more in line with or beholden to Iran. How much is what we're seeing here aligning with, say, that larger trend?
It could be quite a lot. And there were even reports this past week that the whole reason that Hamas fired those 200 projectiles into Israel last Saturday and Sunday, this is massive, it hasn't happened for years, was in order to please Iran. Iran is the sole backer of Hamas right now. Hamas does not have many friends at all. And so they do want to prove themselves willing to fight against Israel. This week, I think it was Tuesday or Wednesday, there was a celebration in Gaza, and attending that were a number of high-level Hamas operatives. And there was a direct live feed from Iran. Qassem Soleimani, the head of the Quds Force, was giving a speech to them. Now, the speech broke up after 2 minutes for some reason, which is probably the Israelis. And there were numerous Hamas high-level members that didn't go for fear that they were going to be attacked by Israel, since there'll be so many of them around there in that location. But nevertheless, it does speak to Iran's influence over Hamas. I think a couple of weeks ago, we talked about how Hamas should be viewed as an extension of the IRGC, mm-hmm. of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. And I believe that's an honest assessment of the situation on the ground, and that's even being reported in a way in the Israeli media. But it may be pushing Israel to the edge, where they are going to have another war to the likes of which we've seen 2006, 2008, 2014, and we haven't had one since then in Gaza. And so we could be arriving at that stage today.
Well, it does seem like the threat has been there, and we've seen these provocations. It seems like more of them have been coming from the direction of Syria as opposed to Israel's other flank here. It's interesting that this is flaring up. How do you view this in the larger context of just Israel's position? We've talked about some of the ways that Israel has actually been gaining leverage. You know, the prime minister has been talking with President Putin. He certainly has a strong advocate in the White House. Where does this leave Israel in terms of its freedom to act in a situation like this?
Well, I think Israel is still overwhelmingly the stronger military force. It can act in Gaza without a huge fear of massive casualties. Whether it's worth going to war over, that is the decision that a lot of the media pundits are tossing around right now. Oh, is it worth any lives? What's going on? The Lieberman said that we are losing our deterrence. And we sent, I think it was it 500 tons? I've got a quote somewhere around here. 50 tons of explosives were sent over to Gaza last Saturday by the Israelis to blow up 40 different sites from Hamas, and they still attack. And so he's worried that we've lost our deterrence, and so we need a war. Whether Israel is vulnerable or not is not really I don't feel it's vulnerable in Gaza, but if you had two fronts started, that might be a more vulnerable situation. But it's more this war of attrition where Iran, they're settling in. Hamas, they're in it for the long game. They will keep on picking at Israel to the point where Israelis just keel over. They're hoping that Israelis just roll over. When it comes to Gaza, we've talked about Gaza even with the pullout when it happened in 2005, how Israel has this wound where they think that if they are able to give up land, that for some reason they're going to achieve peace with as a condition from the Palestinians. Gaza has proven that over and over again. Ariel Sharon, when he gave up the Gaza Strip, he said, hopefully this shows the rest of the world and the Europeans, they'll get off our back about giving back the West Bank, because they'll see that we gave them Gaza and you know, this will be good for us. Mm-hmm. Well, as we said at the time, you know, that's not going to be the case. This is opening up a wound for Israel. This was meant to be part of a peace process deal. giving back the Gaza Strip. And that's yet, here we are again, Israel toying with the idea that it has to go and fight a full-scale war in Gaza, which really does hurt the Israeli economy. And it really does give, it really does hurt the morale of Israel as well, that we've lost so many lives already, and yet why haven't we fixed the problem? Well, as we, as our editor-in-chief brings out in the Jerusalem Prophecy book, this land for peace type of situation is a deadly wound. It's something that they, the Israelis think will bring a solution, but it hasn't. And that's actually part of the fulfillment of prophecy regarding regarding the peace process.
Well, any listeners who are interested in more information on just how to view these events in light of prophecy, look at that booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy. It does put the entire peace process in its prophetic context and the problems that Israel has. I think that's it's a good reminder of just, well, what is it that kind of created this problem in Gaza in the first place? And it was that very bold move that Sharon took back in 2005 to demonstrate Israel's willingness to have a peace partner in the Palestinians, or to at least make concessions that the Palestinians would be able to show themselves partners in that process. And that has proven to be a major mistake. So we can see that happening to this day. But Jerusalem in Prophecy, an excellent resource for anyone interested in more information. We appreciate that, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. After Donald Trump met with Vladimir Putin in Finland this week, all the talk in America is about how shameful his conduct was, how weak he was, speaking of the American president. Well, is that an accurate read? Here's where looking at things in light of Bible prophecy can really help your perspective on events like this. We are going to turn now for this story to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the Helsinki summit was a really significant event. I mean, a tremendously significant event over the past several months. Looking at in context, it's just surprising is that the media, well, I guess not surprising, that the media is really focused on the parts of it that weren't necessarily so significant. I mean, yeah, I've seen comments. There's one former Watergate prosecutor saying that it's on the level of Pearl Harbor and Kristallnacht, how shameful the Helsinki summit was. It's not nearly that bad, at least not the parts they're focusing on, where the coverage you've heard most likely is the fact where the reporter asked President Trump what he thought about the allegations of Russian election hacking, and Trump pointed out that his intelligence agencies hadn't turned over the server yet. He'd talked with Putin. Putin said it wasn't Russia. And he didn't see any reason why it would be Russia. And then I think later he clarified that he meant to say wouldn't be Russia. Mm-hmm. So, but which, whatever it was, that's the scandal that they're looking over. Is like, well, he's thrown his own intelligence agencies under the bus and supported Putin. And personally, I think his comments were ill-handled. Although given some of the revelations, given some of the revelations about how involved his intelligence agencies were in rigging the election, it is kind of an open question over whether it was the Russians or the FBI whose behavior was more shameful.
Mm-hmm.
But what I want to focus for in this program is just a much bigger story that had occurred earlier that day, where President Trump gave a press conference where he's talking about, he's highlighting some statistics about how dependent Eastern Europe is on Russian oil. He's proposing, now that America's got this global fracking revolution, that America now needs to be the one to step up and start exporting natural gas to Eastern Europe to break them away from that independency. Very critical of Germany, pointing out that Germany's building this Nord Stream pipeline in order to allow Russia to just bypass Eastern Europe and send oil directly to Germany, pointing out that Germany gets 60-70% of its natural gas and oil from Russia, and even saying that Germany's pretty much controlled by Russia because of that.
Right.
And so this is something that he's got a solution where he's wanting to step in here and export American natural gas to kind of break both Germany and Eastern Europe away from Russia's sphere of influence. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Russia's not thrilled with that. Eastern Europe's probably pretty optimistic. And even Germany, at least amongst the corporate Germany, isn't thrilled with that because, I mean, there's a lot of big German politicians and German businessmen who are making a lot of money building these pipelines. Mm-hmm. And things like that. And I'd written an article last year titled The Real Russia Scandal, where I even bring up the point that the reason Russia may have hacked America's elections is to sow discord in the United States to prevent the scenario that Trump's talking about from coming to pass, where the U.S. becomes an oil and natural gas exporting giant who's able to send natural gas across the Atlantic Ocean to Europe and breaking them free from Russia's orbit. And that is, we've talked in this program already in some of Richard's segments about those prophecies in Isaiah 23 and Ezekiel 27 about this anti-American mart of nations, including Japan and China and Germany. And in Ezekiel 27, it also mentions Mesach and Tubal, which are ancient names for the peoples that settled in Russia as part of that mart of nations. So we know from Bible prophecy where this ends, is that it ends with Russia allying with Germany in a economic power block that besieges the United States. So you know that President Trump's plan to try to pull Germany and Eastern Europe into an alliance against Russia is not going to work out. And that is kind of what this is the big story that the media's missed in here. They keep talking about, well, he made a comment that he's not sure if Russia hacked our elections or not, which means that he's basically in league with Putin. Mm-hmm. He's not in league with Putin. He's fighting with Putin for Eastern Europe mm-hmm. over who's going to be the energy superpower there. And at the end of the day, it's going to be Germany and Russia that come with some sort of plan to break America's efforts to pull Eastern Europe into its orbit.
Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury recorded a Key of David program this week on this very thing and talking about the collusion between Germany and Russia being this a massive deal that has been exposed here, that Donald Trump is out there speaking about. He's calling Germany out on it. He's calling Russia out on it. And it is quite extraordinary. I mean, I guess that will air next week. And he's also writing an article for the coming print edition of The Trumpet about that. But that really is a huge, huge story. And you would never see the American press, just considering the level of animus that they have toward Donald Trump, actually taking those comments to heart or running with them. What is he talking about? Let's dig into the details of these accusations that he's making. But in a sense, you're talking about the actions that Donald Trump is taking really have been considerably more aggressive against Russia than certainly his predecessors was, with all of the accusations of collusion and him being in Putin's pocket and so on. The actions really do speak louder than the words.
Right, because when you look at the President Obama and the Democratic Party here in the United States, for his first term and like a good portion of his second term, he was very conciliatory toward Russia in both word and in deed. Now, after the alleged Russian hack on the Democratic National Convention, they definitely stopped being conciliatory in Russia in word. They were pretty mad at Russia for hacking their servers, but they still didn't really up their actions against Russia at all. President Trump has been very nice to Putin in what he says, but in what he does, I mean, he's trying to export gas to Eastern Europe to break them out of Russia's sphere of influence. the Obama administration was sending Ukraine blankets and canned food to help in their fight against Russia. The Trump administration gives them like grenade launchers and weapons to fight the Russians. And the Trump administration's sanctions on Russia have actually been quite a bit stiffer than any of the Obama administration's sanctions were as well. So both in weapons, energy exports, and in sanctions, the Trump administration has been far more aggressive towards Russia than the Obama administration ever was. And so if you're making the case that Putin wanted President Trump to be elected, that plan has backfired on him spectacularly because it's hurt him in many ways.
So it will be interesting to watch, like you said, knowing the outcome based on Bible prophecy, how this plays out, and everything that we've been talking about. In some ways, it's all related to one another, that we are going to see this alliance between Germany and Asia. Although it will be short-lived, it would be enough. It'll be enough to kind of break America's back economically before those two powers begin to go at each other. So watch for that article in this coming print edition of The Trumpet, and watch for that Key of David program from Gerald Fleury next weekend. Thanks for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, Japan's massive stockpile of material for nuclear bombs, an interesting proposal from Barack Obama in his first major speech since leaving office, and a new law in Israel that points to a biblical truth. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Japan does not have nuclear weapons, but it's the only non-nuclear country in the world that reprocesses spent nuclear fuel from its power plants into plutonium, which could be used in nuclear weapons, and it has a lot of it. To learn more about this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, news broke this week that Japan has now stockpiled enough plutonium to make about 6,000 atomic bombs. So, as you said, this stockpile is the result of that process that Japan uses to fuel its nuclear power plants. Once the fuel is spent, they reprocess it, they enrich uranium, and they extract plutonium. So, you know, it's supposed to function exclusively as a fuel source for Japan. And of course, the Japanese leadership insists that they have no plans of using this for any sort of military purpose. But as you said, plutonium can be used to create nuclear weapons. So the sheer volume of it that Japan has now amassed is sounding alarm bells. The leadership says the stockpile has only grown so large because several of their nuclear power plants have been offline since the Fukushima disaster several years ago. So because of that, they just have, you know, a lot of it building up there. But not everyone is convinced. And some analysts say that this is evidence that Japan's kind of leaving its options open on nuclear weapons. I've got a statement here from Hideyuki Bon. He's the co-director of the Citizens Nuclear Information Center in Tokyo. And he's among those who fear that this plutonium could be weaponized. On Tuesday, he gave an interview to Channel News Asia, and he said, "Japan appears to be caught up in the idea that in an emergency, it can produce nuclear weapons with its reprocessing technology." So it is a really concerning development. I mean, 6,000 atomic bombs. We know that Japan is incredibly, proficient with its technology. They're an astoundingly industrious people, brilliant when it comes to innovations and technological achievements. So how long would it take to convert this stockpile into weapons? For the Japanese, not long at all if they decided to go in that direction.
Bring us up to speed with just the talk about actually becoming nuclear within Japan.
Well, officially, it's very taboo. You know, you'll never find a leader, anyone who says we should become a nuclear power, possibly on the fringes. The most hawkish right-wing extremists in the Japanese government may say we need to develop nuclear weapons. But that's very, you know, it's not mainstream at all. It's still quite taboo because of that World War II legacy. Mm-hmm. You know, just of how fanatical the Japanese were during World War II in their basically their drive to try to take over Asia and the world, they displayed a fanaticism that was just off the charts in terms of what even the most ruthless military powers have done in history. So because of that, even the Japanese seem to know that they shouldn't be given weapons of mass destruction on that scale.
And yet we've talked quite a lot about just how consistently Japan has been increasing its military capability and moving away from that pacifist constitution.
Yeah, that's right. This news about Japan's stockpile of plutonium does come during a time when we see Japan very steadily abandoning that pacifism that was enshrined into their constitution and taking concrete steps toward remilitarizing. Just last week, we spoke about Japan moving to acquire first strike capabilities for the first time in the form of the Jasser cruise missiles. That marks the first major purchase of offensive weaponry that Japan will have made since the end of World War II. Japan's also in the process of buying F-35B jets right now for use on its helicopter carriers, so that's a major development. Just this week, news broke that Japan's defense ministry will be requesting a record budget of $47 billion for next year, and that marks the sixth consecutive annual increase in defense spending. And each of these is going up by billions each time. So it's there's with the plutonium right now, there's speculation, there's concern, but in these other measures, it's concrete, it's undeniable, it's clear that Japan truly is abandoning pacifism and becoming a full-fledged military power.
So when you look at this story from a prophetic standpoint, and we even talked about just in the first half about the absorption of Taiwan into China and this Asia in prophecy, that all of these nations eventually are going to come together and to unite into one military bloc. That is clear within prophecy. So you mentioned Japan's technological proficiency, how their nuclear capability, I guess whether they actually build nuclear bombs themselves or not, you could still see that plutonium coming into action within a nuclear program, maybe even a broader Asian nuclear program.
That's a great point. Yes, the Bible is very clear that one of the main players in World War III and in the events that lead up to the return of Jesus Christ will be a massive Asian power bloc. And scripture shows that it will be led by Russia and China. But if you look at Ezekiel chapter 38, it lists some of the ancient names for the peoples that make up modern-day Japan as also being a part of this very powerful Asian confederacy. So it would be easy to envision a scenario in which China or Russia, both of which have powerful nuclear programs, especially Russia, could say, we would like this plutonium, and how quickly they would be able to have kind of a pan-Asian nuclear program, perhaps if they wanted to move in that direction. So, yeah, when we see Japan militarizing today or even stockpiling plutonium today, it is setting the stage for that Asian power bloc that is prophesied in Scripture to be just a more powerful military superpower.
Where would you send people who want more information, Jeremiah?
We have an excellent booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy, and it really just examines all of these scriptures about the Asian power bloc and its role in World War III, what that role will be. So we'll have a link to that booklet. There's a whole chapter in there about Japan, and it puts it all into context powerfully.
Thanks for that. This past week, Barack Obama gave his first major speech since leaving office as U.S. president, and in it, he espoused a pretty radical idea. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Former United States President Barack Obama was invited to speak at the Nelson Mandela Annual Lecture in South Africa on Tuesday. And in the hour-long speech, he devoted a fairly sizable chunk to the idea that government should give people a universal basic income. This is a scheme where basically the government provides every citizen with a certain amount of money each year for doing nothing. It's like a replacement for welfare, where welfare is based on giving government money to the poor or to the needy. A universal basic income is basically giving someone a living salary, giving everyone in the nation enough money to live on. And if you want more money than that, then you have to go get a job. In the speech, he used the rise of like artificial intelligence and other technologies as kind of the excuse that he's saying that would need this. He said now that like robots are doing more jobs that people used to do, unemployment's going to get worse. And so the government needs to start taxing the rich more and giving everyone a basic amount of money to live on. And sounds like a pretty radical idea. And even even 10 years ago, most people would have agreed with that. But it is an idea that's gaining a lot of traction in especially the Democratic Party in the United States these days. The co-chairman of the Democratic Party said the concept had a lot of merit. There's one poll suggests that actually probably about 48% of Americans would support some type of universal basic income, which is a fourfold increase to what it was just a decade ago. But the comments are interesting in that while this may be a new and rising idea for many Americans, it's not a new idea for Barack Obama. I've written before in the Trumpet where back in 1996 when Barack Obama was running for the Illinois Senate, he signed a contract pledging to associate himself and support with an organization called the New Party in Chicago. And this was a socialist organization really influenced by the ideas of economist Frances Fox Piven. And she was famous for her her strategy of implementing a universal basic income in America by overloading the welfare system. Basically, the strategy was to get Democratic activists to go out there and get as many people as possible to sign up for welfare until the welfare demands bankrupted cities. Then the cities would have to apply for bailouts from the federal government, which would bankrupt the federal government or threaten to bankrupt the federal government. At that point, under threat of going bankrupt and seeing riots in the streets, you'd get the political capital you'd need to implement a socialist system where you raise the taxes. They said then if you raise the taxes high enough, you can just have outright redistribution of income.
This is a pretty bold kind of naked exposure of what this is really about.
A pretty bold plan. They basically wanted a socialist system where you tax the rich and then use their money to give a basic living income to everyone. They knew that you couldn't never afford that plan under current tax rates. And when you take into account the loss of incentive to work that happens when mm-hmm. you give people this, you probably could never afford that plan ever under any circumstances. Mm-hmm. But in her mind and possibly in Obama's mind, he figured the only way to do this is you need to get really high socialist level tax rates, and Republicans will never agree to that unless it's the only way to stave off a civil war. So overload the welfare rolls, and then under threat of collapsing the economy, people will adopt this. And so that's kind of a That was the goal. That was their strategy to get the universal basic income that former President Obama was saying the world needed so bad in South Africa this week. We can put in the show notes Mr. Gerald Fleury's article, The Dangerous Roots of America's Turn Left, which gives more information on some of Barack Obama's radical socialist past ideas and some of the biblical prophecies about how ideas like this are actually leading to civil and urban unrest in the United States.
There's also the article that you've written about this. You can find it on thetrumpet.com. Barack Obama voices support for a universal basic income. It's amazing just how how radical of a departure this is from anything historically that you've seen within America from a man who's just been out of office for 18 months, and what a departure from everything that America has stood for economically to this point anyway. But there certainly does seem to be more and more public support for this type of thinking. We appreciate that very much, Andrew. And our final story today, the state of Israel passed a law this week that underlines a point we often make here at the Trumpet. We talk about the biblical identity of modern nations as a key that gives us understanding of Bible prophecy. Well, one nation has made it official. For this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this is a law that finally came into effect overnight on Thursday. It's been 7 years in the making. And it established Israel as the national home of the Jewish people. You might wonder why it hasn't been part of their constitution before, or their basic law, which is tantamount to a constitution here. And that's a good question. They've been here for 70 years, Israel has. And it was a state created, even if going back to the Balfour Declaration, as a Jewish state or a state for the Jewish people, Israel. And yet it was only voted on, only passed this past Thursday. And along with establishing as the national home of the Jewish state, it also established Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. It set the Hebrew calendar as the official calendar of the state, recognized Independence Day and a bunch of other things. So it's basically making the status quo that exists on the ground law. That is the way that it is. And it's finally establishing that. And there are a lot of people that are up, have, you know, there's European nations, obviously the Palestinians are upset about this, which is strange, because in eight of the European Union countries, the ethnicity of that country is talked about in its constitution. So Israel has done that finally. But it's interesting. 70 years ago, had they decided to call their state Judah instead of Israel, or something to do with being the Jews, then we might not be facing this kind of conundrum that we're in right now. But as you even brought out in the introduction there, I think it is just a good time to really understand what the state of Israel, who the state of Israel is. While it has the name Israel, and if you look into the Bible, there were many tribes that made up the nation of Israel anciently. And there were only some of those tribes, the southern tribes, the southern kingdom, that was called Judah, was known after the lead tribe, Judah. And the Bible, when the first time the word Jew is used, it's referring to those southern tribes. And so it's really interesting, because you talk to people over here and they just naturally assume we're Israel, we're all the tribes of Israel. You talk to anybody about this, and that's the general understanding, is that all the tribes have come home. But if you look at biblical history as it relates to secular history as well, then only a few of those tribes came back to settle this land, and that being the Jews. The Jews only make up a few of those tribes. And so I see it now, 70 years after the fact, we have finally the acknowledgement that we don't have all the tribes of Israel here. We just have the tribes related to the southern kingdom of Judah.
They recognize it, and If you want to know about what God says about the nation of Israel today, the Jewish state of Israel, you can look at those prophecies and you can see what it says about Judah specifically. The Bible, when it talks about Israel, it's talking about the other tribes of Israel and the birthright nations of Israel, in particular the United States and Britain, as we prove in our booklet, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. But that really is an extraordinary truth that does unlock so much of the Bible. And even we were talking earlier on the program about a specific prophecy related to end-time Judah that gives us an indication of what we can expect in the time ahead. There's a whole lot of prophecy regarding that nation that we can that helps us to unlock those events as we see them happening in the headlines. We appreciate that, Brent, very much. That will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can visit the Trumpet Hour Hub at thetrumpet.com for links to the articles and the literature that we talked about on the program today. You can also email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Great to be here.
No worries.
It's been a pleasure.
Danke, Ben.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Will Durant. Since men love freedom, and the freedom of individuals in society requires some regulation of conduct, the first condition of freedom is its limitation. Make it absolute, and it dies in chaos. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.